Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Today we write the next chapter in our Open House Addiction series, having already covered tech addictions including phones and social media, as well as shopping addiction. Now we turn to a drug that worldwide is responsible for 3.3 million deaths every year. In Australia, one in four 25 to 39-year-old deaths are directly attributed to this substance. Globally, the average age for early experimentation with this substance is as young as 12. In Australia, it's younger still. We speak of alcohol. Dr. Nyanda McBride is a senior research fellow and team leader at the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University, WA. For over 16 years, Nyanda's research has focused on reducing risky alcohol use and saving lives. Dr. Nyanda McBride, thank you for joining us in Open House. Why are Australia's young people experimenting with alcohol earlier than many other countries?
I think the social acceptance of alcohol use in many different areas is one of the key aspects. My specialty area is looking at young people and alcohol. And certainly, you know, we see a high level of alcohol use. In fact, young people from 12 to 18 years of age are the highest drinking group in Australia. And, you know, that's reflected in the harms and the experiences that they have. What we do know is that there are some key influences on young people's alcohol use, and that is parents, peers, and community groups such as sporting groups and so forth.
At what age does the average Australian have their first taste of alcohol, and is that age getting younger?
Okay, well, we've looked at this. We look at this quite regularly in the work that we do because we're very much involved in interventions to reduce risky use, consumption, and the harms that young people experience from use. And we know that this hasn't changed very much over the years for the majority of young people, that experimentation generally occurs between the ages of 13 and 14, and then more regular use in a proportion of those young people will occur after that age, from 14 to 15 and so forth. And we know that there's certain increases at different ages. 16 and 17, there's a slight increase, and we sort of think that might be associated with a bit more flexibility in their lifestyle. They get their driver's license, they might get, they've hit the legal age of drinking and so forth. I think they're important points to look at in terms of trying to intervene.
Nyanda, in your experience, is there any clear connection between early alcohol experimentation and a problem later in life?
There is some international literature on that that says if young people are exposed to heavy drinking from a young age, they're more likely to become dependent on alcohol use at a later age. I don't think there's too much definitive research on this in Australia. I think Australia is quite a unique population. I think it's really important to do research on Australians to find out what Australians are experiencing in this. But there are some longitudinal studies that are starting to inform this a little bit more. And I think that, you know, in terms of what can be done to help reduce the chances of this happening, we probably know that there's no quick fix, and that a number of components from a whole comprehensive society point of view should be addressed if we're going to, optimise what can be done. And, you know, that from a young person's point of view, that might be looking at the education that they have in schools around alcohol use, programs that might support parents to help young people reduce or not get into excessive alcohol use. What are sporting clubs doing, and how are they modelling alcohol use, and what can be done to reduce that, and laws and so forth, etc.
On that theme of education, you've pioneered the School Health and Alcohol Harm Reduction Project there in WA. What's involved in the SHARP project?
Okay, the SHARP project is a classroom-based project, and we decided to focus on classroom because we knew that you captured most of the students in the classroom situation. Schools, because, you know, schools are there, they're an existing setting for education, and we know that most young people will be there. And part of my background is that I was once a secondary teacher in schools trying to teach alcohol education.
Wow.
And, I remember standing in the classroom thinking, my gosh, this isn't working. They're not really interested. And thinking myself, gosh, you know, it doesn't really excite me either. What can I do? And fortunately, as a researcher, I had the opportunity with my colleagues to have a look at alcohol education in particular. And when we looked at it, we found that most of the programs in the past were looking at abstinence or just say no programs. Whereas young people were telling us through the prevalence data that yes, we are drinking, and just through interactions with them, that if you tell us just to say no, we're going to ignore you. So we knew we had to come up with another way that linked into what their experiences were and that sort of resonated with them. Having said that, included in that harm reduction approach is a very important message that if you don't use alcohol, then you're less likely to experience harm associated with alcohol, even though you may be exposed to other people who are experiencing it, who are using alcohol, even if you choose not to. So the harm reduction message is important for that group because they're going to be experiencing alcohol use situations where harm might occur, but also for the group that are drinking and do choose to drink. And no matter what we might want to say or what we might want them to do, they will continue to drink. And we needed to get link in with both those groups rather than giving out the just say no message.
So given that as teenagers, our frontal lobes are very much a work in progress, how as an educator do you connect an intellectual knowledge of the dangers of alcohol with a very emotive response to just about everything as a teenager?
Well, you know, I think the fundamental thing and the reason why SHART was such an success was that we went to young people and we did focus groups with them and we asked them about their alcohol using situation, where they accessed alcohol from, what harms they experienced, what strategies they put in place to work through issues with peers and so forth. And we actually took that information and it's incorporated into the program along with, you know, what the current research literature was telling us, what the experts were telling us. And also we had to fit it into the school setting. So we needed to know what teachers were experiencing and how a program would best work for them. And I think that is the core reason why SHARP was such a success in terms of behaviour change. One of the other aspects of that was that once we got a draft intervention incorporating all that information, we did a pilot of it and we took it back to the young people and we took it back to the teachers to find out whether this is the type of thing that they could work with and that would work for them. And we got really positive feedback from that formative development process. And I think that to engender change in young people, that type of thing needs to occur.
Nyanda, you mentioned that the SHARP program was a success. Give us an idea of how significant a change you witnessed as a result of the program.
Well, after the formative work, we did a longitudinal study and we followed young people from the beginning of their secondary school to the end of secondary school. And what we found was that students who participated in SHARP versus students who participated in regular alcohol education, if it was provided by the school, had a better alcohol-related knowledge, had safer alcohol-related attitudes, things that are pretty important, but probably most importantly was the behaviour change. And we saw a change in the total consumption of alcohol, in risky consumption, and also in the harms associated with their use of alcohol. And then most of the changes occurred when the program was delivered in that year 8 and year 9. However, we measured further on and we found that some of those changes, which was really unusual for alcohol education in schools, had a longer-term impact. And that really was related to reducing the harms that they experienced in alcohol use situations.
Is SHARP available to all schools across the country, or is this something that schools on the East Coast could learn to incorporate in their own curriculum?
Well, we have a SHARP website that we put in place in 2006 to make it freely available to anyone who wanted to use it. We did update SHARP in 2012 with the teachers and students just to see if there were any changes, and one of those changes was, of course, the social networking aspect and the harms associated with that. So the most recent update is available from SHARP. Individual schools can download that free of charge. There is, however, just tick a box for a Creative Commons agreement. However, if others are going to use it more widely, then we ask them to fill in a license agreement just so that we're aware of how it's being used and so that we can get important messages across, like if you are going to use it and if you want to expect some or increase your chances of behavior change, then, you know, the SHART philosophy, which is the whole program, needs to be taught as closely as possible to documentation, yeah. because then we know that, that is likely to bring change.
Nyanda, given all of your experience, how can mums and dads meaningfully connect on issues of alcohol with our teenagers?
Now, that's interesting you should ask that, because that's one of the next phases of research that I'm very interested in doing, and in fact have put in a couple of funding applications that haven't yet been successfully funded, I think because of the competition in funding arrangements these days. However, there are glimpses of what parents might be able to do. If parents monitor their young people's activities, as particularly when they're away from their parents, you know, what friends they're with, what they're doing with the friends, and where they're going to be, and regular mobile contact. If they do that, and if they have rigorous rules and regulations around alcohol, and if they, you know, are role model appropriate alcohol use, which is, you know, not heavy use and not used to intoxication and so forth, then these things can play a part in reducing the exposure that young people have to alcohol. However, I think it would be really important to find out other particular interventions that might work with parents. How would they like information provided to them? How would they interact with other parents or their peers to have a group understanding of how they can reduce the exposure that their young people have, or that their children have, to alcohol and risky alcohol use situations? And I think that this would be really interesting research to do, to find out what parents want, what they're experiencing, and what some of their strategies are.
Nyanda McBride, thanks so much for your time and your research around alcohol and our teenagers. And we'll post a link to the SHART project on our Facebook page and openhousecommunity.com.au.
Great. Thank you very much for that.
Continuing our exploration into alcohol abuse, we turn now to the minimum drinking age for a moment, always bubbling just below the surface of our public consciousness, and usually only coming to the fore when our young people in particular are caught up in alcohol-fueled tragedies. Another key voice in this conversation is Professor John Toomberu, who serves the students at Deakin University's School of Psychology and the Centre for Mental Health and Wellbeing Research. He's also the CEO of Communities That Care. This is a not-for-profit training and consulting collaboration between the Royal Children's Hospital and the Rotary Club of Melbourne, focused entirely on building stronger and healthier communities through the reduction of substance abuse, like alcohol, in regional areas. One of their successful programs is the Alternative Schoolies Project for graduating Year 12 students in that state. More on that in a moment. Professor John Toomberu, welcome to Open House. Share with us some more detail about the Communities That Care program.
Well, Communities That Care has been operating since the early 90s, and it really was developed by a research team at the University of Washington. It now operates internationally. Our experience in Australia now has been running for over a decade, and the idea of this is that communities can make a huge difference to children's lives as they're growing up. But we need advice and we need assistance to understand what the best programs are and the best activities that we could run that will support the healthy development of children and young people. And so this is really, at base, what this is about.
John, what changes have you seen come about in the communities where this project's been running?
Well, the main measures that we use are the children's report of their own behaviours and the social environments they're growing up in. So young people complete the Communities That Care Youth Survey, which is an instrument that's being used again around the world for planning community initiatives. And one of the things we find there is they are able to tell us quite clearly whether or not the families they're growing up in have high rates of conflict, whether mum and dad will know what they're doing when they're out on their own, and whether there's good communication there and a sense of loving bond. They can also tell us how school life is going, whether they're being bullied, whether it's easy to get drugs in their community. And of course, knowing this information is vital, and it's really quite odd if you think about it that we really haven't thought of getting this information before.
Yeah.
Because it can give us real leads as to how to intervene to improve the communities for young people. So if we're hearing from them that they're easily able to buy cigarettes from their retailer, then obviously checks can be done and the retailers can be alerted that they shouldn't be doing that. And the same, so too, if there is high rates of family conflict, families can get support in order to develop communication skills to address that problem. And that's basically what we know is that over time, children report under the community care framework improvements in these key environments, and we're relating those to reductions in a whole range of problems. So we're seeing, for example, on our across the Mornington Peninsula Shire, which is the longest running site, and they've actually had terrific reductions in alcohol, tobacco, antisocial behaviour, early sexual risk taking in their early secondary school population, and that's congruent with the experience internationally where there's been randomised community trials run and where the program's been rolled out across the whole state of Pennsylvania in the US. And so the US experience is congruent with the measures that we're seeing here in Australia.
John, how do we get a program like Communities That Care set up and running? What's the first step?
Well, the very first starting point is really with the adults in the community. So they form a coalition that is focused on getting improvements in these young people's report of life in their community. So they're really very much focused on improving the social environments using evidence-based approaches. And the goal of Communities That Care is to increase investment in those types of areas. So then the young people would interact with the program by being invited to be part of the coalition that's formed, and also to take special initiatives that they might regard as being important, or that has been shown through evaluations in other areas to make a difference for young people. Now, they might involve things such as mentoring or being a tutor to another young person. It might involve being in doing the checking program where we check whether or not the retailers and the bottle shops in the community are actually doing the right thing and not selling alcohol to underage youth. So we have youth participating in these types of activities. They're also in part of community events where we have in some places various schools will get together to get educational information about such issues as advertising and the culture around youth alcohol use, and we also encourage alternative activities. So, for example, what we're trying to do at the moment with our partners at Rosebud Secondary College in the Mornington Peninsula Shire is encourage an alternative schoolies adventure where the school is refocused from being about alcohol to taking travels overseas to a disadvantaged nation such as Timor-Leste.
John, traditionally teenagers are pretty quick to rebuff any change driven by adults. How did the teenagers of the Mornington Peninsula react when the program came to their school?
Well, the young people are very enthusiastic. I think that they realise that the culture is very much focused on alcohol, and they're really recognising that that really isn't a good future.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of young people that are very keen to see change, and so we call these people the champions. In the younger groups, particularly early secondary school, we've had feedback that our program message that young people should wait until they reach the legal drinking age before they try alcohol. That has been a message well received. Young people in the early secondary school period say that they're tired of the culture that they see with adults where the drinking is very heavy, that they prefer not to be under pressure to drink, but they say that they probably can't change things themselves, but they can if adults take a stand and if others support them. So they're saying that they're really looking for a community-wide effort to change the culture.
You mentioned the alternative to the traditional schoolies on the peninsula. How did that go last year?
Last year we had the first group go from the Rosebud Secondary College to their Friendship Village in Timor-Leste, which is Los Palos, and they had a very well-received program where they were sharing with the young people over there things that they had learnt through their secondary school education. So the focus of that event is very much on the idea that we in Australia have the privilege that we have good opportunities to go to school, and this is something that in Timor they're just so keen to develop. So the young people over there, of course, were delighted to be able to interact in the various events. There were events there where our young Australians were teaching skills such as drama, and there was a bit of tap dancing that happened in an event. And, of course, everybody was just so pleased over there. The Schoolies Week in Australia falls on the Independence Day in Timor, and some of these celebrations were helping to celebrate Independence Day in Timor, and that again was very well received by the village chiefs, who said that they could really picture this being a really good cross-cultural exchange.
John, it sounds like this has been a boon for the Mornington Peninsula community. How can parents around the country bring a program like this or this program to their community?
Well, if people wish to explore a bit further Communities That Care, they'll see that there is the website there that they can find easily through Google, or it's there under the Royal Children's Hospital. It's part of the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. And we have a section there as to how any single individual can actually work to bring Communities That Care to their community. Again, the idea is that you act as a champion and you try to hold a meeting, which we're very happy to support, in your community. They can email me. My website is clearly listed, and my team are very happy to come out and support those early activities. So from that early meeting, that attracts other champions to the table, and from there, people then begin to work through the phases of Communities of Care to improve lives for the children in their communities.
It sounds like an awesome initiative. John, you've dedicated a lot of your time, both professionally and personally, to programs around alcohol and drug abuse in our young people. Why are you so passionate about this cause in particular?
Well, as I guess there's two levels to that. I think that one of them is that, obviously, being a professor at Deakin University, I'm in a position where I do have the privilege where we can take leadership initiatives and we can work in partnership with the community. So there's opportunities there. Secondly, I think it's also been through very good understanding and education that I received through my research career working at the Centre for Adolescent Health at the Royal Children's Hospital, where I've learned a lot about the way in which problems develop, and I've become very passionate about the idea. I think it's myself and many others also feel that we can have a much brighter future if we take on board these changes to make sure that we bring in positive influence for children and young people and we reduce some of the negative influences. And that does require us to get somewhat political and speak up. So I think that it's the knowledge actually moves you increasingly to realise that we do need a bit of a game changer here.
Professor John Toombaru, thanks so much for the update on the Communities That Care program. We'll have a link to that page on our website, openhousecommunity.com.au, and on our Facebook page as well. Definitely worth a look. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Let's have a closer look at that Communities That Care initiative, Alternative Schoolies, running through Rosebud Secondary College in Victoria's Mornington Peninsula last year. The college's graduating Year 12 students were given the opportunity to forego their traditional schoolie celebrations to work with kids in East Timor. Last year, Joshua Finlay did just that and joins us on Open House. Josh, great to catch up. How did you come across the program first?
Well, initially I found out about it from a teacher at school. So she came to one of my assemblies and basically spoke to the year level about what was coming and what the project was all about. And yeah, it was just really stuck with me and something that really interested me. So went along to the info night and just went from there, I guess. Yeah.
Josh, I don't know what your school is like, but generally school is regarded as a bit of a rite of passage. What was the reception like when the alternative schoolies was proposed?
It was fairly minimal. The response was fairly minimal, to be honest. Yeah. I think in my level alone, we maybe had, well, including myself, it was maybe 5 students who expressed an interest, and that, you know, dwindled down to about 2 of us.
Of how many students all up?
There was approximately 250.
So the two of you head off to the info night where you hear officially the idea is to do something other than head to the beach, drink too much alcohol and pray the pictures don't turn up on Instagram. What does the project actually look like to you?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it was, I mean, to me it just seems like such an extraordinary opportunity. It's something that you're never going to get presented to every now and again. So I was just the sort of personality that just wanted to grab the bull by the horns and just take it on. But yes, I mean, certainly it would conflict with that school is culture, and a lot of people just didn't feel comfortable with it. So I think it took a certain type of individual to take on that opportunity. Through Many Hands International, which is the organisation that was running the program, we headed over and did arts-based workshops with different school kids.
In East Timor?
In East Timor, yeah. So it was a fairly amazing opportunity, but yeah, we did a few different things. I ran a few dance workshops. The other girl who went ran some arts workshops, and we got to see a really wide range of kids over there, which, yeah, was really amazing and quite an experience for both Laura and I and the other girl who went. So, yeah, definitely a life-changing experience for me. In terms of East Timor, you never really know what to expect. So we sort of had a baseline idea of what we wanted to do, and we sort of just had to adjust when we got there, because a lot of the time we were told, you know, maybe 20 kids might show up, and in the end about 100 showed up. So it was definitely something that tested our ability to, I suppose, adapt and multitask and all those skills. So, yeah, it was sort of that thing where a lot of the planning went out the window in the end. But
So number one lesson, flexibility.
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
Definitely became a lot more flexible from the trip. And I suppose putting things into perspective as well, that's the main thing that I got from the trip, was sort of putting my own life and what I think is a challenge into perspective, and thinking, well, really, I've got it pretty cushy over here. So,
Josh, share with us some of the more stark contrasts between your life at Rosebud High School and that of kids and their families in East Timor.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. I mean, as soon as we got out of the airport, it was seeing, you know, a developing country for the first time. I certainly wasn't prepared for it mentally, so I think that was a bit of an induction by fire, to be honest. But I think the thing that really stood out to me was just the richness in the culture of the people. I mean, sure, there was a lot of you know, baseline, you know, poverty and that sort of thing, but just the energy and the welcoming of the people, it was so incredible and something I've never really experienced before. And you sort of look past the deprivation of the roads and the long car trips and the, you know, the rubbish and, you know, dogs running everywhere. But when you look at the people and, you know, just how appreciative they are to have you there. And one of the most amazing things I ever heard on the trip was after a workshop that I did. And I was talking to one of the girls, and she asked me, what are you doing in East Timor? And I said to her, well, we're here to do some volunteer work, but for me, I'm also here for a holiday. And she was so surprised and so shocked that someone would want to come to East Timor for a holiday. And yet she was so proud, so proud that someone would want to come to her country for a holiday to enjoy themselves. So, yeah, the people just really made it all worthwhile.
In that time, since you've been back, how has the change in your perspective manifest itself in your life today? What is it now that you do or don't do that was not the case before?
I think I'm a lot more patient than I was before, and a lot more confident as well, because you put into these situations where it really pushes you to adapt and be flexible and just interacting with people, not relying on a script and all that sort of stuff. So it really pushed me to go outside my comfort zone. And, I mean, that's one of the main things that's translated for me. I've found that I'm a lot more outgoing, and I sort of take things by the horns a lot more and just go with it, really. So, but, yeah, that's been the main thing for me, just how much it's pushed me to just go outside my limits and try something new.
When you came back home and heard from your mates about their schoolies, was there any sense of regret? Did you feel like you'd missed out on anything?
No, absolutely not. I talked to a few friends after I got back, and the comparison, I mean, there was no comparison in my mind. They did stick to that cookie-cutter formula of schoolies, you know, going away, camping on a beach and, you know, drinking copious amounts of alcohol. And you know, I look at that and I look at what I did with my schoolies, so to speak, and it really just didn't compare for me. It honestly didn't. And
you don't regret not going?
No, not at all. I feel so privileged that I got this opportunity, and I wouldn't have traded it for anything in the world. So I was over the moon with what I experienced. So,
Josh, was there any change in the way you related to your family after your time in East Timor?
I'm not too sure, to be honest. I certainly got back and appreciated my relationships with my family a lot more. I suppose the security and the closeness that we have here. So I suppose in that regard, I, you know, learnt that. But, yeah, it was just really good to get back and see them, to be honest.
Yeah, I bet. One last question, Josh. What's next for you?
At the minute, I'm doing disability services, studying that. And, yeah, I'll finish that this year. And I'm hoping I can go back to Timor as soon as possible. It's sort of whet an appetite for travel, so head back as soon as possible. But, yeah, I'm seeing where life takes me now, to be honest, and that's what Timor has taught me, just to see where life takes you and take each day as it comes and appreciate life, really. It's been really great.
Josh, terrific to have a chat with you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Dwayne. Have a great day.